Yeah, I think that's really the normal state of play, right? That, we see these periods where prices boom and they go way higher. And then we see maybe a period where either price is correct or a prolonged period where they really don't change. But, over time, the trajectory is up and to the right at a fairly modest pace, slightly faster than inflation. So yes, I think longer term, I would agree with that projection.
Let's get ready to scale. Hey guys, welcome to yet another episode of Ready to Scale. I'm your host, Jeanette Friedrich, Director of Investor Relations at Blue Lake Capital. Joining me today is Greg McBride. Greg is the Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com, which, if you're not familiar with this website, I highly recommend you check it out. Basically, they lead a team that's responsible for researching all kinds of financial products, providing analysis and advice on personal finance. It's very helpful. Greg has actually appeared on hundreds of national cable and network broadcasts, including CNBC and Fox Business Network. So we're really honored to have him here on the show today. He has a bachelor's in science in finance from the University of Florida, and he's also a CFA charter holder. And he's coming to us live today from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. So welcome to the show, Greg.
Great to be with you, Jeanette. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we dig into our conversation, I do want to remind you guys to make sure that you like, rate, and review the show. Don't forget to click the subscribe button. And now let's dig into the much more fun stuff. All right. So, Greg, first of all, mortgage rates are crazy. They are so high, and yet we're continuing to see basically home prices rise even alongside that. So, this has definitely been very frustrating for anyone that's actually in the market, whether they're a potential seller or buyer, because it puts people in a, a challenging position. What are your predictions for the housing market in 2024?
Well, the housing market continues to be hamstrung by a very low level of inventory, homes available for sale. And so that's really kept not only a floor under prices, but has really helped continue to push prices higher despite mortgage rates that are now over 7%. They had hit 8% in October. They fell pretty notably by the end of the year below the 7% mark, but they've since bounced back up above 7%. I think that's short-lived, but bottom line is, I think mortgage rates are going to come down, but come down slowly. We're not going back to 3 and 4% rates. So, if your plan is that you're just going to hold out and wait until that happens, I hate to throw cold water on that. And just, I think it's really the inventory that's been the main driver here, because, if you think back to the go-go days of the real estate market, right? As we were coming out of the pandemic, 2021 and into 2022. Demand was way up here, supply was way down here. And so prices were going up by leaps and bounds. Yeah, they were, people were having to bid way above asking price, those type of things. They were buying sight unseen. We don't have that type of environment. It's an environment where, demand is still here and supply is here, right? So you still have more demand than you do supply. And that's provided some lift, continued lift. To prices, albeit at a much more modest rate, despite the fact mortgage rates are as high as they are. You also keep in mind, one third of home buyers are paying cash. So, as much as we talk about mortgage rates are a lot higher now, there's a third of the market that's not sensitive to that at all because they're paying cash.
That's an excellent, excellent point. I'm curious, what have you seen as far as in the pipeline? What type of supply is expected to come online for residential homes in 2024?
Yeah, I don't expect that we're going to see a big deluge. I think it'll slowly improve just as people come to grips that the fact that, oh yeah, maybe mortgage rates aren't going back to 3 or 4% anytime soon. Those move-up buyers that they've been reluctant to let go of that 3% or 4% mortgage rate for today's going rate. I think as they realize that, oh, you know what, maybe those days aren't coming back. If we're going to move out of this neighborhood, we're going to get that home in the school district that we want. We're just going to have to bite the bullet and take the lead. And so I think this slow improvement on the inventory side, but it's not going to be a deluge. It's not going to be enough, I think, to really even right size the market. I think it's one that inventory is still going to stay just tight enough that it puts a floor under prices. So, that's the other thing. If you're sitting back expecting that we are going to see some broad-based correction in single-family home prices, other than isolated markets, that's just very unlikely to happen because of the fact that even now, demand still outstrips supply.
Very interesting. And I'm curious, of course, what is your take on the multifamily market? Do you think that the bubble has burst there? Or, what are your insights that you have from all of the data that you study?
A lot of volatility there and also variability. So, for example, a lot of the supply issue that we talk about, the limited inventory of homes available for sale, a lot of that's being alleviated by new construction. We see new construction in the single family home segment, but a lot of the new construction is coming on the multifamily or has come on the multifamily side. So, that's where you're seeing, I think, a different dynamic. You've had a lot more supply come onto the market, despite what the consumer price index shows on the ground, rents have really stabilized. So you're not seeing those type of increases in rents that we were seeing a couple of years ago. You're not even seeing rents go up in a way that home prices are going up. Rents have largely stabilized. And in some markets where, the supply demand is a little out of whack because there's excessive supply, you've actually seen rents pull back. So, much like there's a lot of angst about the commercial real estate sector, the residential real estate is really, really strong. Some of that multifamily, it kind of falls in the middle in the sense that in areas where there's been an abundance of new supply come on the market, the prices are a little squishier. In other areas where inventory is still very, very tight, even with that new supply coming on the market, you're still seeing some pretty heady price points.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely attest to that from our end. It's been interesting. We definitely have seen rents softening across multiple markets. Now, there is a difference, of course, between softening, meaning that we are still able to achieve premiums. They're just not ridiculous premiums like we were able to really enjoy, back in like 2020 and 2021. And it is interesting to see how it'll play out. It's our opinion that as the supply steadies and levels out throughout the rest of 2024, that we will see, rents begin to increase again slightly into 2025 and 2026. Would you concur with that?
Yeah, I think that's really the normal state of play, right? That, we see these periods where prices boom and they go way higher. And then we see maybe a period where either prices correct or a prolonged period where they really don't change. But over time, the trajectory is up and to the right at a fairly modest pace, slightly faster than inflation. So yes, I think longer term, I would agree with that projection.
Well, good, good. I'm glad somebody else besides me is saying that. So that's helpful. All right. Well, good. Well, now I'd like to get into talking about portfolio structuring. And what is your advice, given the fact that you study, all kinds of different investment vehicles all the time, and you've been exposed to a lot of this really interesting data that most people don't, actually even access. How would you advise people they should structure their portfolios?
Well, I think there's, first of all, we've got to talk about sort of what's the time horizon on that portfolio. And for example, the same person may kind of think of a few different things. Your retirement savings is a lot different from, say, the money that you're accumulating to buy a home in 2 years, which is a lot different from the emergency fund that you need to accumulate. Most Americans are undersaved on all those fronts, both emergencies as well as retirement. So, if we start with retirement, the longer range, time horizon, that's where you need to invest aggressively, heavy into equities, low cost, well diversified, broad based index funds, really the best way for most individual investors to go. What we had seen is, I think up until just a few years ago, there was a real reluctance among younger generations to embrace the stock market. I think if there's one thing that kind of came out of the meme stock craze, it's that it introduced a lot of those same investors to equities. And so, my concern 5 years ago was that millennials and Gen Z to follow them, they'd have the biggest retirement savings burden in history, and they had decent savings habits, but they weren't investing it appropriately. They were way too conservative. think that's changed. So again, if there's one positive that came out of the meme stock craze, it's that millennials and Gen Zers, they're now quicker to embrace the riskier portfolio that's equity heavy and more suited to that multi-decade time horizon. And again, I draw a distinction between that and say other shorter term needs or just that emergency fund that everybody needs. So only about a third of Americans actually have an adequate emergency savings fund. So most Americans are undersaved in that area. And this is money that needs to be liquid, federally insured, accessible at a moment's notice if you need it. And the plus is that in this environment, you're being paid for that savings in a way that you haven't been in about 15 years. The savings rates now top out over 5% in an environment where inflation is 3, 3.5, and moving lower. So, you're getting paid on that savings in a way that you haven't in a long time. It's not dead weight of the portfolio. The other way to think about that is it's the buffer between you and high cost debt when unplanned expenses arise. So, don't shortchange the emergency fund just to be, chasing go-go performance and higher risk investments.
Excellent advice. Excellent advice. What about crypto and the fact that it's now beginning to actually emerge, officially into the markets? What's your take on that? What do you think is the future of crypto?
Well, I'd say it looked much to my surprise. I don't think it's probably not going away. I think maybe some coins or programs will, but by and large, it's probably not going away. Especially when you look at something like Bitcoin or Ethereum. But there's not an intrinsic value there. It's hard to value it. It doesn't kick off an income. It's a purely speculative asset. So I'm generally not a fan because, like I said, most people are undersaved for whether it's long range goals like retirement or short term goals like emergencies. And so, the focus or the priority should be on saving more and putting that in vehicles that can generate the return you need over the time horizon you need. Speculative assets, become almost a luxury in that sense. So, not a huge fan. Most investors really kind of need to focus on meat and potatoes, broad-based, well-diversified, low-cost a portfolio of equities, maybe a little bit of bonds, depending on your time horizon. And that the more speculative investments that particularly don't have intrinsic value, that becomes a luxury, not certainly not a necessity.
Excellent. And also, don't forget real estate, Greg. You forgot to say real estate. Where do you think real estate comes into the portfolio?
Well, I did. Yeah, you're right. And the reason I didn't mention it there is because most people, they've got all the real estate exposure that they need in their home. That's still where most Americans have the bulk of their wealth. Unfortunately, when people retire all too often, they're not retiring with hundreds of thousands of dollars in their 401k, but they might have hundreds of thousands of dollars of equity in their home. So, most Americans, two-thirds of Americans are homeowners, and a lot of homeowners, particularly long-time homeowners, the bulk of their wealth ends up being in their home. So that's a very healthy real estate allocation that people have just by virtue of making the mortgage payment month in, month out over the course of several decades.
Yeah, very true. Very true. All right. Well, next, I'd like to get into actually talking about what's been kind of all the rage lately, which is money market accounts. But before we do, let's have a word from our sponsor.
I'm sure that you probably feel frustrated right now and like you don't quite understand what's going on with multifamily investing. You may have invested with one or two syndicators and feel that you don't understand multifamily investing and want to know more. Listen, multifamily investing shouldn't be a black box. It's also not a rocket science. And that's why we started the Blue Oak Multifamily Fund. Those who join the fund are going to have an exclusive access to our investor mastermind, where we're going to share some secrets from behind the scenes and going to walk you through how we invest, how we source deals, and how we deal with today's economy. Hi, I'm Ellie Perlman, founder and CEO of Blue Lake Capital, a private equity real estate firm, and I invite you to join our exclusive multifamily mastermind. As a sponsor, we're committed to doing more for our investors, and this is part of it. So if you want to take multifamily investing knowledge to the next level, go to bluelake-capital.com / mastermind. I hope to see you there.
Okay. All right, Greg. So let's talk money markets. And so it was interesting because before we started recording, and we were kind of reviewing what we were going to talk about, I mentioned money market accounts and you said accounts or funds. And I said, oh, solid point. A lot of people probably don't even realize that they're two different things. So please help explain for all the listeners what is going on with money markets and what an account is versus a fund.
Yeah, this is an important point. People use the term interchangeably. They oftentimes don't realize there's a difference, or they'll use one term when referring to the other. So, yeah, it's important to point this out. Money market accounts are like savings accounts. They're bank accounts. They're federally insured. There's not a fluctuating value to that. You put the money in, you know it's going to be there when you need it, and you're going to get paid for it in the form of interest in the meantime. Money market funds, very similar in objective. These are all geared towards short-term needs, cash that you need to get your hands on at a moment's notice. Money market funds are a little bit different. They are mutual funds. Mutual funds, of course, pool investors' money and then invest in a number of different assets so that every investor is diversified from the first dollar that they invest. Well, the thing about money funds is they're very, very safe, but they're not federally insured. So it's just, an important distinction between those and the bank accounts, the money market deposit accounts or bank savings accounts. Also, the returns on money funds, they tend to be more tightly clustered because money funds, they're all fishing out of the same pond of investments. And what they pull out of that pond and ultimately give to investors gets defrayed by the expenses of the fund. So you don't tend to see the same dispersion of returns on money funds that you do on money market deposit accounts and savings accounts. So, money funds tend to all be, the returns tend to be tightly clustered together. The differential is more reflecting their expense ratios than their investment philosophy. Whereas bank accounts, savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, those yields can range from literally next to zero all the way up to yields well over 5% in this environment. You say, well, geez, why can they be so varied? It's because what a particular bank is paying is up to them. It's a reflection of their need, their desire to bring in deposits or keep the deposits that they have. And as savers, we're able to exploit that to our advantage. You can put your money with another bank that's paying a higher rate of return, get that higher rate of return. You're still protected by federal deposit insurance. You can still get to the money when you need it. And you can link it to the checking account that you have with your current financial institution. So, you don't have to change anything about your day-to-day routine. You're just going to send your money somewhere where it's going to be welcomed with open arms and higher returns.
Yeah, very good points. And I know also that, just to make it very clear to listeners that the funds do carry more risk than, the simple money market account, which is really just like a savings account, essentially. So just want to make sure that was very clear to people. Now, it's been interesting because I have heard some pushback in the markets, from investors that say, hey, why am I going to get into this real estate deal when I can go over here to this money market account with no risk and get 5%? And my answer to that always is that, that's not actually a long-term investment strategy. It's a very short-term, beneficial, opportune approach that you can take in the short term, but ultimately, that's not an effective long-term investment strategy. It's simply, a savings tool, right? And of course, they also do not include sales proceeds. So you're not going to see equity multiples, coming out of a money market account. What else would you say, is just important for people to understand are the pros and cons of, these simple money market accounts that have become very, very popular?
Well, they're very popular because you can earn 5% with no risk, and that's been a long time since we've been able to say that. And so that has certainly garnered investors' attention. And there is a place for it, whether it's your emergency savings, whether it's part of diversifying a broader portfolio, or it's just the money you want to park at your brokerage and have at the ready in the event that the market corrects and you want to buy at a moment's notice. So there's very much a need for that in the portfolio. But as you said, it's more for meeting those short-term or more immediate cash needs. It's not a long-term wealth-building strategy. And those 5% returns that we see today are going to be a real return. When the Federal Reserve starts to cut interest rates, those returns are going to decline. So again, not that that makes it a bad investment, because it's absolutely appropriate for the emergency fund or other short-term cash needs we have. But that 5% return that might be distracting an investor from an otherwise long-term investment horizon, 5% is not going to be around forever. You know, those longer-term investments like real estate, like equities, yes, you're going to have a little bit more volatility of price, but over a multi-year, multi-decade horizon, those are the vehicles that really help you create wealth.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, definitely agree. Of course. Along those lines, when it comes to creating wealth, is there any additional advice that you'd give to listeners that have that as their very specific goal?
Yeah, a lot of it really just boils down to the fundamentals. It's not a matter of doing anything fancy. It's, about doing the fundamentals very, very well. Live within your means, be a disciplined saver, automate the process, pay yourself first, do the savings before you have the chance to spend it. That's payroll deduction into your 401k, automatic monthly transfer into your from your checking account to your IRA, direct deposit from your paycheck into a dedicated savings account for that emergency savings, automating the savings as much as possible, tracking your spending and holding yourself accountable so that you can then identify other opportunities where you can boost that savings. If you're spending less than you make, it gives you more opportunity to save more. And then in terms of once you've saved that money, investing appropriately for the horizon. Yes, you're going to need a pool of cash for the short-term unplanned expenses, but you also need to invest more aggressively for the longer range goals, whether that's retirement, education for your kids, whatever it may be. And that's where you have to be willing to take a little bit more investment risk. And aim to keep your expenses low. Mentioned the broad-based low-cost index funds. I think for most investors, that's really the way to go. The less you pay in expenses, the more you keep for yourself.
All right. All right. Very good advice. Now, last but not least, before we again pushed record, just kind of giving the listeners some insight, I was talking about how I spent some time today actually watching the small business committee for the SEC putting together their final recommendations based on the definition of an accredited investor. And so, this will be airing next week, and maybe by then they'll have finalized their recommendations and it'll be out in the world. But for this moment, it appears to me, based upon, watching their meeting, that they're going to not make an adjustment to the financial requirements of what it means to be accredited versus non-accredited, but that they are considering actually bringing up or involving some type of educational component, some type of testing component for non-accredited investors to be able to gain access to investment opportunities that are generally just for accredited investors. It seems like the proposal is going to allow them to take some type of test and then allow them to invest up to 5% of their net worth over a 12-month rolling period, so that they can gain access to, these types of opportunities and help support, new startup companies and all kinds of other things. So if this all comes about, which I know it's, not even for sure yet, what do you think could be the broader implications of suddenly opening the floodgates just a little bit more for unaccredited investors to get into new types of investments?
Well, I'm all for education, working for a personal finance website, all about helping people make informed financial decisions. So, to the extent whether it's accredited or unaccredited investors, having some sort of educational component, I think is highly important. You got to know what you're getting into. Limiting that to 5% of the portfolio is, certainly appropriate. That's not going to ruin somebody's portfolio if something blows up and it's only 5% of the portfolio. So, I don't think that it's going to, be a game changer in the sense that it's going to, open up access to a lot of capital that's currently sitting on the sidelines. The big money investors are all accredited investors. So, they've already got access to these vehicles. It's debatable whether you want smaller mom and pop investors that aren't the accredited level to have access to these investments, but at least with an educational component to it, there's, they at least have some knowledge of what they're getting into. But with smaller dollars within that 5% portfolio limitation, that limits their downside risk, but also limits the upside benefit as well.
Yep. Yeah. Very true. Very true. I've always found it very interesting that accreditation is not required for crowdfunding or the stock market or anything else, which can be equally volatile and, you know, lose a lot of money for people. You know, yet, you know, kind of in this one particular realm of my world, you know, it has a major implication. So, yeah, I'm very curious to see, you know, how it all plays out. But anyway, thank you so much for, you know, taking your time to just share your expertise with us. We definitely appreciate it. The last part of our interview is simply what I call the lightning round questions. So if you don't mind giving us a little more insight into your world, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So when you're not, you know, looking through a bunch of different data and different products, what do you actually do for fun?
I love sports, love travel, and love the outdoors. So, you know, those three and the things that combine all three of those.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. What about as far as a book? What book would you recommend, you know, that particularly our listeners, which the majority are, you know, obviously real estate investors, what book would you recommend is really important for them to read?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's not going to be one that I think is dedicated to real estate alone, but certainly where real estate is a component. I'm a big fan of the Millionaire Next Door series. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's great reading, you know, really for anyone, regardless of where you are on the wealth spectrum. If you aspire to move up the wealth spectrum, you know, I think those books are a great place to start, great motivation, and, you know, really gives you some serious insight that is maybe different than, you know, I think what a lot of common perceptions might be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Greg, what is something interesting that most people don't know about you?
That's probably the toughest question you've asked so far. I don't know. I'm the most boring person on the planet. So I don't know that I got a snappy answer for that one. Sorry.
No worries. All right. Now, one of the things that we also talk about consistently on the show is, yes, you know, we focus on money, investments, returns, you know, all of that kind of thing. But the reality is that the whole point of this, right, is to build extraordinary lives. It's to be able to, you know, live the type of lives that we can really align with our values and our passions. So what's your advice for someone whose goal is to build an extraordinary life?
Yeah, it's to be well-rounded. It's not just about dollars and cents. You know, it's, you know, about building a life that's going to make you happy, that's going to make you feel fulfilled, that's going to enable you to make a difference in the lives of others. And so, you know, all of those things, money has a component or an aspect to that, but it's not the be-all, end-all. And so, you know, yes, while we talk a lot about things that impact the dollars and cents, you know, sometimes there are decisions you make that really aren't financial in nature, but fall into one of those other buckets. They, you know, the thing that's going to give you fulfillment or that's going to enable you to make a difference in the life of somebody else.
Excellent advice. Excellent. All right. And Greg, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they find you?
I'm at bankrate.com. You can find me on Twitter or X. I'm at Bankrate Greg.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you very much. Very insightful. Really enjoyed our conversation. It was interesting to me. And I hope for those of you listening today that it was also valuable for you. Please don't forget, again, to like, rate, and review the show. Leave us some comments. Let us know more of what you'd like to hear. And in the meantime, be bold, be extraordinary, and keep moving forward.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.